Today in Studio 360, what's the best way to piss off a movie director? Let him make an entire movie about you and then sit on it for 40 years. That's what rock and roller Leon Russell did.
Well, I hate new stuff, so I decided I would just let it get older and perhaps it'd be better.
The documentary, now aged like a fine wine, has just been uncorked. I'll talk with Russell about collaborating with rock gods from Mick Jagger to Elton John. And we'll have a performance from maybe a giant in the making. He's just 20 years old, but Shamir is already wowing crowds with his great gender-bending voice and genre-hopping music.
I won't make the same mistake. I'm holding on desperately.
Plus, Lori Frick's artwork is colorful and kind of chaotic. It does not look like what you think of when you think data. But Frick's got a different vision of what data can be.
Take back your data, turn it into art.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But to start the show,
I'm up on a tie wire, flanked by life and the funeral pyre, putting on a show for you to see.
The summer I turned 18, this song was on the radio all the time, and I loved it. It was one of Leon Russell's biggest hits, and he was a one-of-a-kind rock and roll character as well, with his long gray hair and devilish smirk. At that point, he had been a successful session musician and songwriter for a decade, and a couple of years earlier had become a bona fide star collaborating with Joe Cocker.
I'm coming home. Well, my baby, she wrote me a letter.
During the 70s, he forged a big musical career unlike almost anyone else's before or since. An Only in America mix of country and blues and gospel and bluegrassy rock and roll with real-deal musicians from all those different realms participating. And for two of those years, at the height of his stardom, the great documentarian Les Blank followed and filmed Russell. The resulting movie from 41 years ago, A Poem is a Naked Person, it's called, was never released. Until now, for the first time, and Leon Russell is here with me to talk about it. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So, this new documentary about you, as I said, is not new. What's your version of why it took so long to get released?
Well, I hate new stuff. So I decided I would just let it get older and perhaps it'd be better.
Aha, it's a vintage thing.
Absolutely.
But he made this and you didn't want it out there 40 years ago?
Well, actually, Les Blank is a wonderful documentarian. I kind of felt like it had a lot of coverage that didn't really have to do with me, you know, a lot of sunsets and...
There was that, and snakes and frogs and fish and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I had a lot of that stuff. It's okay. It's a good... His son tells me he thought that it perhaps was his greatest movie.
He's made some good ones, but I really enjoyed it. I assume you've watched it anew lately.
Yeah, it was interesting to see. I hadn't seen it in a long time.
I can imagine. To open up this literal time capsule that has been buried for 41 years and look back at yourself in the early 70s, what was that like?
Well, I was cute.
You were very cute.
I don't know. It's a weird thing, really. I'm kind of glad that it's coming out now. I think it's probably better that it comes out now than it would have been if it had come out at that time.
And as I understand it, you and your business partner at the time had approached Les Blank, who was this great and somewhat eccentric documentary filmmaker who had made a lot of movies about music. You approached him to make it. What was the idea back then?
You're giving me the benefit of the doubt that we knew what we were doing, and that's not always the case, but he was hired to make the film.
And did you have an idea in mind? I mean, there had been, you know, there had been the famous Rolling Stones movie. There had been other movies about rock and roll people. Did you have a vision in mind of what you thought it might be?
I really didn't, actually. You know, when you hire artists to do certain things, my theory is to just let them do what they do. I didn't want to get in there and get in the way.
And when you told him, nah, I don't want this to be put out, how did he react at the time?
Well, he didn't kill me. I'm not sure he was very excited about it. But
I expect not. I didn't know at the time, 40 years ago, but I read that since birth you've been a little bit paralyzed on the right side of your body. Is that right?
Yeah, I had a birth injury, an upper vertebrae, that made me slightly paralyzed on the right side, a different growth rate a little bit. And on thinking about it, I was happy that it happened because it gave me a very strong sense of duality. My left side was much stronger than my right side.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't as smart, but it just gave me an outlook into this plane that we live on. And I think if I hadn't had that, I'd probably be selling cars in Paris, Texas.
And as you play music, and let alone dance around on stage as you did, how did you compensate for that, bifurcation in your body?
Well, I thought about it all the time. When I was walking, I'd be about 3 seconds ahead of the steps, so I wouldn't look like I was limping too bad. And that made its way into my playing as well. I always had to decide what I was going to play and then decide if I could play it. I had to do all that in front of the actual real time of actually playing.
It certainly would, I would think, serve to make you very conscious of playing in a way that most musicians don't have to be. They just go with the flow and do it.
Yeah, they don't have to think about it. I wasn't always conscious at that time, but whenever I was thinking about what the next step was going to be.
Yeah, it looks like there was a lot of consciousness alteration watching the film at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you spent the first part of your professional career as one of the primo session musicians in L.A. while rock and roll was being invented. You even arranged the horns for the Rolling Stones on a song on Let It Bleed. So what did you make of Mick Jagger?
There was a guy called Kim Fowley out in Los Angeles who used to do that dance that Mick Jagger is famous for. I'm sure that's where Mick Jagger got it.
Really?
It was from Kim Fowley because Kim was over in London right before the Rolling Stones hit. And I can't help but think that Jagger saw him because it looked just exactly the same.
In 1970, you collaborated with Joe Cocker, and it was the moment you really broke big. I want to listen to one of the hits that you wrote for him, Delta Lady. Listening to that song and especially watching the documentary, I was really struck all over again at the way country and blues and rock and gospel all were bleeding into one another, in your music anyway. And in the film, you see what a great motley multicultural scene it was. Long hairs with square white bluegrass players and black people and young people and old people. It's easy to look at the film and think, wow, country music, that could have gone a different way after the 1970s rather than the way it did. As you see how music has evolved in the last 40 years, what do you think?
Well, it seems to have a mind of its own. You never know what music is going to do. I myself like the old style, you know, a little bit less pickup beds and beer and tailgating. I like more of the old time of country music.
I am with you on that. A few years ago, you collaborated with Elton John on an album called The Union, which was a hit. I'm going to play one of the songs from that album.
If it wasn't for you, I'd be happy. If it wasn't for life, it'd be true.
That's the song If It Wasn't For Bad off of the album The Union. So how did that project come about?
He was working with Billy Joel, and he wanted me to write some songs for them. And I said, well, what kind of songs do you want? And he said, up-tempo, baby. And then he called me back in about 15 minutes. He said, well, I think we ought to do a record together. So I said, well, sure. I always thought somebody would come back and get me. But Elton was the only one that did.
Did it surprise you that he was the one?
I don't know. I'm surprised that anybody remembered me.
And you made The Union, and it was commercially successful, critically successful. That must have felt pretty great, as you say, when you felt like you were had been left alone for 20-odd, 30 years.
Well, it was great. I had just gotten out of the hospital and had a brain pan operation. It was kind of hard for me. I found myself falling asleep, but I was about an hour late for the first session. And the time I got there, Elton had written 5 songs. So he's ready to write, and I'm ready to write. And that was a great experience because he'd say, well, here's an idea, write this. And I'd write it in 5 or 10 minutes and hand it to him. And then he'd take 5 or 10 minutes and write the music. And it was the way I like to work, actually, very fast.
When you sit down to write a song, how do you go about that? What do you start with?
Well, I mean, for many years, I'd sit in the front seat of my bus. I had my computer, but I'd just sit and write. And I ended up with probably 1,000 pages of lyrics, all different kinds of lyrics. I wasn't writing anything in particular. The thing that I learned when I was doing that, I always had so much trouble writing. I had studios in my houses for 45 years, and I'd get in that studio and I'd sit there and wait for inspiration, which was not forthcoming. And I got kind of sick of that, and I said, I've got to figure out how to do this so I'm be like an accountant. I go to work and I do it, and it gets done, and it's not, you know, I don't have to depend on non-existent inspiration. So I got a book called How to Write the Popular Song, I think it was called. And it gave me some tips about how to do it, and I studied it, and that's the way I do it today. It was quite a helpful publication.
Really? So Leon Russell, after 40 or 50 years writing popular songs and being a rock star and all the rest, a book called How to Write a Popular Song actually was useful.
Oh, yeah. I may have the title wrong, but...
it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The documentary about Leon Russell, called A Poem is a Naked Person, is out right now.
I often think of life I live, and it's a wonder I ain't dead.
The generation of Leon Russells, Elton Johns, and Mick Jaggers inspired whole waves of kids to pursue rock stardom. Kevin Barnes was one such kid. He's the lead singer of the band called Of Montreal. They've made a name for themselves with theatrical, over-the-top shows that harken back to the heyday of glam rock in the 70s and 80s. But Kevin Barnes was not a born performer. He was an awkward teenager who says he had no friends at all until he discovered how to play rock and roll. It happened one summer at a campground.
My family used to go on camping trips all the time. That was just a thing we did in the summertime. And this is in Ohio. 13, just getting into music, but it was all very mysterious to me. You know, like, I didn't understand anything about production or songwriting. And I had this uncle who brought a guitar to the campground. And I was like, oh, man, I really want to play the guitar. So I asked him if he'd show me something. And so we're sitting in this hot pop-up camper, and the first thing he showed me how to do was how to play Under My Thumb by the Rolling Stones. Just that the riff that's actually played on a marimba. That do 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 do. He's showing me, you know, how to hold the guitar pick and where to put your fingers. And then he taught me the chords. And we started singing it. Under my thumb, the girl who once had me down. It probably was really rough, you know, like if someone's like trying to like remember where to put their fingers, that was like extremely slow and awkward, but I'm sure it didn't sound very good, but to my ears it sounded beautiful.
Oh yeah, the difference in the clothes she wears down to me, a change has come, she's under my thumb.
And it's sort of a revelation for me. You can, you know, learn those simple things pretty quickly, and then the whole world of pop music opens up to you. And for some people it might seem really lame, but for me, you know, as a 13-year-old, I was just like, I couldn't even believe it. You know, like, oh, wow, okay, so I can play that song, but now I can also play like every Rolling Stone song ever written just because I know like how to do that one thing. Around that time period, I got this collection of Rolling Stone singles. It's called The London Years, I think. And like, especially the early songs were pretty simplistic. So I would just sit in my bedroom and play the tape and just listen to it and try to figure out, okay, so which bar chord would that be? You know, okay. And that's how, you know, sort of uncovered the secrets of songwriting. Just from learning that one Rolling Stone song, I was able to, you know, learn Beatles songs and the Hollies, the Kinks, the Who. I just really dove headfirst into it and spent all my time playing the guitar. I kind of lost interest in everything else. Then I started writing my own songs, you know, using those chords and probably lifting a lot of the melody lines as well.
Damn, wish you were born. Could have been your boyfriend, I know it's not possible now. I just never met a girl I like half as much as you and we.
But the funny thing was, I remember being frustrated that I couldn't write anything that was as cool to me as those Stone songs. Like, what is it? Like, I understand the chords, but I didn't understand at the time, like, how much of it was, like, the attitude. It took a while for me to get to the point where I, you know, sort of dug myself and happy that I had my own personality and my own style. Some of my songs, if I would just take like one section of the song, that would be most people's whole song. Like on the new record, there's a song called Dower Percentage, and it's kind of exhausting, you know, it's like chord, 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 chord. It never stops changing chords. And I think it's just the way my mind works. But I'm always trying to create the hook, not a generic hook. something that feels special and has that magical spark to it. That's the thing about the Stones. They always had really great melody lines, and they're fairly simple, but each one's fantastic.
Kevin Barnes from the Band of Montreal. Our story was produced by Lital Molad with help from Max Bernstein. Is there some song or maybe a movie or novel or some other work of art or pop culture that changed your life? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org and we may put your story on the air. Coming up, for 2 weeks, Lori Frick's every move was tracked and logged electronically. She wasn't being followed by the FBI or NSA. She put herself under surveillance for the sake of art. And she thinks we should all give it a try.
I mean, I really have this crazy idea that your data can come back and give you this sense of mindfulness.
A more peculiar and softer side of data, just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. If you've been listening to the show, you know that we've set a new challenge for all high school students. We want them to be funny. The contest is called Funny Ha Ha, and it's a chance for teenagers to try humor or comedy writing. The comedian and actor and writer, BJ Novak, will be the judge, and he's got some advice.
Great comedy is the same as a great mystery. Or a great brain teaser, a great riddle, something that is so obvious that you never would have thought of. So I would say try to surprise people with something that they knew but never put their finger on.
There is only one hard and fast rule for this competition. The first line and the last line are the same for everyone.
The first line, the sun rose and everything fell. The last line, Alex stared at the door handle and slowly turned the knob. What happens in between those two lines is up to you.
You need to get your submissions in by midnight, August 3rd. BJ Novak will pick the winner on the show. All the details are at our website, studio360.org/funnyhaha. Every time you visit a website, like studio360.org, or use an app, you're generating a little piece of data. Every time you go online to buy something, or share a photo, or like a Facebook post, each of those actions becomes data. And when you don't know who's got access to your data, whether there's a corporation or government agency looking over your shoulder, it can be a little worrying, or maybe a lot. But this new reality does not faze the artist Lori Frick. She's based in Austin, and her latest exhibition is centered on one idea. Don't be afraid. Be creative. Get your data and turn it into art. We sent Lindsay Patterson to find out exactly what that might look like.
I'm in a bright, white-walled gallery in New York City, where I've just met Julie Ho and Stephen McMillan. They're game to give me their reactions to Lori Frick's new show called Who Are You? What Day Is It?
Oh my God. Wow.
We look at one piece on the back wall.
I like it a lot. I want to go look at it closely. It looks like small squares of different textiles, probably leather or some kind of leather. There's a day of the week and a time.
The piece we're looking at covers the entire wall. The leather-covered blocks meander up and down in a scattered, wavy line. At one point, the blocks appear to fall off the bottom of the piece and pile up on the floor before continuing up the wall again.
And the textile are all different colors. Oh, some of them are painted? Interesting.
It looks like it's someone's like life strewn around. Some things are heavier, some things are tiny squares stuck there haphazardly. And yet then you like move through like the evenings and it's nice and orderly as everything's calmed down. Because the times that are messy are like late on a Friday or early on a Saturday when you're tired from the week.
I pointed out the legend mounted on the wall. Each colored block represents time spent on an activity, sleeping, eating, working in the studio, and so on.
Interesting. It looks like from far away, it's like almost like a topographical map or representation of something. And it looks like, well, obviously it's 14 days of her life. That's really cool.
So they liked seeing Lori's data, but how did they feel about data in general?
There's a lot of times when I think it's really magical because it lets you like find things that you in your own self or things in the world that fit you really well. And like, that's really beautiful. It can be a little scary at times when you're like, how did you know that?
I think it's always startling when a machine can put together analysis of you that you weren't able to do for yourself. And it's just kind of like that light bulb moment where you're like, oh, wow. And then you're like, oh, wait a minute. The machine knows more about me than I do. And it's like, holy crap.
Julie and Stephen had latched on to the point of Lori's art, that tension between wonder at what data can do and the concern about having personal information available and accessible to people other than ourselves. Lori Frick thinks that art can help ease the anxiety.
Right now, the thing that is making people nuts is that they know they're being tracked, and their only, you know, avenue is to turn off location tracking on their iPhone.
We have this feeling of powerlessness, she says, but that could change if we were able to claim ownership of our data.
I'm predicting that this data is going to come together with the world of art, that art is going to be a way that you see yourself, that you see your own data, and that that will turn into these things that look hand-built in the spaces that you live.
Well, what gives you the reason to think that art and design is going to be part of this rather than just like, here's the data?
It turns out when you see something physical that's tangible, like if you look at this bumpy, textured piece of, you know, blocks, your brain actually fires the parts that are like your fingertips touching it. The tactile nature of something that's physical and handmade affects the way you experience it more viscerally than if it's just flat pixels on a screen.
Lori's time as an artist in residence at a neuroscience lab convinced her that there's real physical benefits to combining art and data.
I mean, I really have this crazy idea that your data can come back and give you this sense of mindfulness, boost your immune system, you know, change the walls in your house and not have it be this big investment of art, but it's this weird personal experience of where you've been or just some interesting insight about you.
Are you going to have a startup that does that?
You know, I tried that a little bit with FrickBits.
FrickBits is her app that uses location tracking to give you your own custom Lori Frick data selfie. Still, art on your phone is one thing. But Lori is now re-envisioning large-scale installations, like the piece we saw in the gallery, as cheap, personalized, and recyclable.
What if you captured this and you got this little 3D printer that printed out something with all these little bumps of what your day looked like, and you got a new one every few days? Or it fell off the end and it went into the little recycle bin and the pump squirted it back on the other side.
Sort of like a water feature of data.
A water feature, exactly. Exactly. I think art is just one of those ways it's like nobody can argue with it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's nothing bad. Take back your data, turn it into art.
But we're not yet at the point at which the average person can take back their data. There's not yet an easy way to connect and store it all. But Lori counters that by arguing that we're in the Wild West phase of data before the ethics and standards have been fully figured out. When consumers start demanding access, we'll get it, she says. And data won't be scary anymore. It will be beautiful. Perhaps. Back in the gallery, I asked Stephen and Julie, could art, theoretically, help them overcome an aversion to data?
I mean, I think that's where we kind of are right now, is that we're trying to find all these ways to, like, own a little bit of the data ourselves, and we're really, really happy handing it to someone else if it comes back and, like, shows us something really beautiful about our own lives, or shows us a really great video or article that we wouldn't have seen otherwise. And it's really weird to think about how much of your life you can really capture and how that really can be displayed in a very, in this particular case, a very unique and very beautiful way.
I'd want to know more about myself, so hopefully I could be more grateful for who I am and what I can do.
For Studio 360, I'm Lindsay Patterson.
I really want to touch it, but I know you're not allowed to touch this.
I know, I want to put it back together.
Yeah, totally.
You can see some of Lori Frick's work on our website, studio360.org, or if you happen to be in New York City, it'll be on view at Pavel Zubok Gallery through July 25th. Still ahead, his career is just starting, but Shamir Bailey's already played with all kinds of sounds, from country to folk to rap to electronic.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't care. I just wanted to play what I love.
Shamir plays what he loves right now, right here, live in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. A year and a half ago, Shamir Bailey was an 18-year-old just out of high school making music in his bedroom at his parents' house in North Las Vegas. Since then, he has been the toast of South by Southwest, seen his face on a Times Square billboard, heard his single in an ad for Google's new smartwatch, and the "wow, you gotta hear this dude" buzz continues. Like Madonna, Bailey goes by his first name alone, Shamir. His music borrows freely across genres, from country to rap to disco. What ties it all together is his giddy energy and his totally distinctive voice.
We're just shells that earth dwells.
Shamir's first album, called Ratchet, is out right now, and he has come to Studio 360 to join me. Welcome.
Hi.
Hello. So, I read that you got a guitar and started playing music at age 9. Did you make a decision early on after that that, oh, this is what I want to do, sing and play?
Pretty much, yeah.
What, by 10?
Exactly.
Really?
So it was I feel like I wasn't, like, actually, like, really writing, like, decent songs till, like, 12.
So that people can learn what we're talking about, will you play a song?
Yeah.
Or what will it be, the first one?
The first one is called Demon.
Great.
The honor roll was all I'd known till you took me over to the dark side. The thrill was good, together we stood like a modern day Bonnie and Clyde. We'll stay in the run. For survival, no books but the Bible. Hold out with a gun. My wings turn black, no turning back. Yeah, you have me completely. Enriched in you, together we flew. Yeah, you're the trap that captured me. Falling off so gracefully.
That was Shamir playing the song Demon from his new album Ratchet, with Davion Canada on drums, Tiffany Payne on backing vocals, and Danielle McGinley on keyboards and vocals. So you learn to play the guitar at 9 or 10. You perform at a talent show. Then at some point, did you just start playing gigs, or did it stay in your bedroom?
No, then I started, like, this is like when I was like trying to do like more like acoustic folk, like country stuff. And I went to like a few honky tonks, did a few country competitions, and
really,
yeah,
that's interesting. Southern Nevada honky tonk country competitions.
Actually,
you must have stood out.
Exactly. It's very off-putting for a lot of people.
Was it interesting for you as a 15 or 16 year old doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't care. I just wanted to play what I love.
Yeah. And I assume that when you were going to high school in North Las Vegas, you were not like most other kids. Did you find a crowd to hang out with, like the music geeks or the literary people or the theater kids?
Yeah, that was my problem. I couldn't find a crowd. I talked to like the same maybe like three people every day, and like if somehow all three of those people were in like there at school, I would like sit by myself. But in a weird way, everyone still knew of me because I stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, yeah. But they didn't give you, the horrible version of that would, and they bullied me, and they put me in the locker, and they beat me up. None of that stuff?
No, people kind of expect that. You know, now that I think back, you know, I was like, I don't know why I didn't get bullied, but I didn't.
Yeah? Maybe Las Vegas is just a paragon of progressivism in America, and it's all about...
I think people don't give it its credit.
Yeah. I've always defended Las Vegas. You tweeted not long ago, quote, to those who keep asking, I have no gender, no sexuality. Really?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I am a type of person that pretty much my whole life I'd never felt like tethered to one gender as far as like gender roles.
Right.
You know,
like, but it's not as though you have no sexuality. It's that you're saying you have no specific fixed one.
Exactly.
Oh.
I'm more attracted to someone's personality.
And your parents were cool with this unorthodox child of theirs?
My mom's a Wiccan, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
And do you accept her Wiccanness?
Sometimes it's hard for me.
Yeah, I can imagine. Was there music that helped you figure out it was okay to be me and all that stuff? Or was this all just an internal mental thing?
I feel like it was something that's always, like, been instilled in me.
Mm-hmm.
Even, like, at an early age, just kind of, like, you know, going up to my mom and, like, telling her that, like, I don't believe in my religion anymore.
Which religion was that?
I was raised Muslim.
Uh-huh.
I was raised in a Nation of Islam.
Really?
Yeah.
And your mother's a Wiccan?
Yeah.
This is like a TV show.
It was like one of those things where like once I came out like at an early age and was like, I don't feel comfortable with this. And
yeah.
She kind of realized that it was kind of, you know, forced upon her by her mom and kind of started to find herself. So I think it was always something like it still made at an early age. But music definitely was like a medium to kind of like help me kind of like do something new, knowing that without all these boundaries.
Right. Will you guys play another song?
Yeah.
What's it going to be?
It's called In for the Kill.
Uh-oh.
Love.
That was Shamir performing In For The Kill from his new album, Ratchet. The people who run the James Bond franchise should have you sing a James Bond theme.
I'm down.
Okay, good. That's settled. You still live in North Las Vegas?
Yeah, when I have like a big chunk amount of like time off, like, yeah, I'm usually in Vegas.
Since you live in North Las Vegas, I assume it's somewhere near that weird edge of Las Vegas where it always strikes me as though I'm on Mars or Venus and the city just stops and then you're in the desert.
Exactly. Like where, like the high school that I went to,
uh-huh.
You can't go any more north than that.
Like, that's just it.
It's just a freeway and then mountains.
So I know you have this super cool record label, XL, who have been this super cool record label for years and years and years.
Uber cool.
Exactly. You signed up to be an intern there even after you'd signed a recording deal with them?
Well, I always wanted to intern at a label, and I got signed. I had to move out here to record the album for 3 months, and I just like needed something to do while I wasn't in a studio. So I was like, can I intern here? I'm like, they can't say no, right? Like, and they didn't. So actually interned under my publicist.
Your life is really, I mean, they should make the movie tomorrow. It's all the scenes in the biopic, or at least in the first act, are here.
Who will play me?
Who should play you?
Zoe Kravitz.
Willow Smith?
Willow Smith can definitely do it.
There you go. Okay, we got two names. And before I let you go entirely, will you play us out with another song?
Yeah.
And what will this one be?
It's a song that's on the commercial, as you mentioned. It's called On the Regular.
On the Regular?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Hi, hi, howdy, howdy, hi, hi. Where everyone is minus, you can call me Multiply. Just so you know, yes, yes, I'm that guy. You can get 5 fingers and I'm not waving high. Yes, I'm never ending, you can call me Pie. But really, how long till the world realize? Yep, yep, I'm the best, what you heard. Anything less is
obviously absurd.
Haters to the bird, more like the eagle. This is my movie, stay tuned for the sequel. Seems so wrong, seems so illegal. Got this in the back like a foul ball free throw. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on a regular, so you know. I come with the trick, with the blow, with the boom. And if you're in my way, there's nothing but doom. Ain't got no time for you ratchet ass goons. Just settle down, listen to my tunes. Ever since I was 8, I was attached to the mic. Wanted a guitar before I wanted a bike. Had an Epiphone, like a Fisher Price. Never seen a song, cause I'm up all night. Really, really? Really, really? You wanna talk? But you know that I am really, really to the fullest. You can call me cancer. No multiple choice, cause I'm the only answer. Ain't got no wallet, only used to for bands. Know my chicken's ratchet, cause bands will make a dance. Wanna get at me? You don't stand a chance. And if you wanna, yes, you can get these pants. Haters to the bird, more like the eagle. This is my movie, stay tuned for the sequel. Seems so wrong, seems so illegal. Got this in the back like a foul ball free throw. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know. 5'10", about a buck 20, skinny as a rat, but still won't quit me. Why is that? You think I was 50, but I take it 50 if you take this lift. See? Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know.
You can watch videos of Shamir performing live in our studio at studio360.org. But I'm afraid that is the end of this installment of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. The show is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Jenny Lawton,
David Krasnow,
Martha Little,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisferum,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Becca Forsman,
Kushel Stocks,
Dasha Lisitsina,
Jack DeSidoro.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the brilliant Taylor Mack dives deep into the history of American pop music and brings it back to life one decade at a time.
And the 1770s decade is about how America was founded on booze, man-boy love, and dandy revenge.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.